This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 20th, 2017. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm bringing you this week the developments. They're brought to you, as always, by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and by your state society of CPAs. What we're going to look at this week is, yet again, a look at what they've been doing with the new tax bill. There's been a lot of changes made in the bill, especially the Senate version. We've had developments on the House side, so I want to keep you up to speed. Good news is they're going on recess this week. So next week we should be able to talk about traditional development issues, court cases, rulings, and those sorts of things that we normally talked about. But clearly at this point in time, the biggest developments we have going on during the week is what's happening with this bill. And I don't know about you, but these have been the questions I've been getting from my clients this week too, is about what the heck's been happening, how does this affect us, and how are we going to deal with it? So we're going to take a look at this and try to figure out how to make some sense on this bill. Now, the key issue here, Congress obviously spent this week on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. When we last dealt with this a week ago, the House Ways and Means Committee had just reported the bill out with a series of amendments. The Senate had just also released an initial draft of the bill. Now, we knew that things were going to be happening this week because the House was going to take it to the floor. And the Senate, we knew that this bill had a problem because the Senate version of the bill, as written last week, was going to violate what's known as the Byrd Rule. The Byrd Rule is a rule that says that for anything going through reconciliation, that is a budget item in reconciliation, to qualify under the reconciliation provisions, the bill cannot cause deficits to increase more than 10 years out. The Senate bill last week, because everything in it was permanent, was going to definitely cause, if you ran the budget numbers, the deficits to go up more than 10 years out. The problem was not what they were spending during the 10 years. They were under the $1.5 trillion cap they needed to be. The problem was that there kept being lost revenue after that date. The House doesn't worry about that. That's not their issue. They don't have to clear this special supermajority if that's true. But for the Senate, that was a problem. So we knew we had major changes coming in the Senate bill this week as well. But the House did actually take the bill to the floor. And the good news, if you want a bill to be passed, is that the House did pass the version that came out of Ways and Means. And they did so by a relatively wide margin. 227 votes in favor, 205 votes against. As fully expected, all the Democrats voted against the proposal, but only 13 Republicans voted against the bill. And I say only 13 because, remember, in the budget resolution that let this thing get started, we were down to far more Republicans voting against the budget resolution moving forward. The main concern, as always, comes from the high tax state Republicans, representatives from the higher tax states, that their concern is that this is going to be a net tax problem for their constituents. The compromise that was arrived at was to allow a $10,000 deduction, up to $10,000, for real estate taxes to be taken. So the House bill contains that. The Senate bill at the moment does not contain that provision. As I mentioned last week, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, has stated openly that if we do not have that provision in the final bill, that the House is going to reject it, that this is the deal that's keeping in line the high tax state Republican representatives who are, you know, taking some risk here voting for it. They are not going to be willing to take the risk to vote for it if they don't have any deduction for state and local taxes, or at least Chairman Brady is afraid that not enough of them would take that risk to allow the bill to pass. The Senate Finance Committee, though, does not have this. And by the way, even as of today, we're going to talk about the changes in the bill so far. Even as of right now, we do not have any deduction for state and local taxes in the Senate bill. But good news was the House passed the bill by a fairly wide margin, and they did so right on the time schedule that we were aimed for. So that was good news for the House. The Senate Finance Committee did this week wrap up their hearings, and they sent the bill on to the floor after making changes. Well, except not really the floor, because, of course, as soon as they finished this, it was time for the Thanksgiving recess. Congress will not come back into session until a week from Monday, so on the 27th of November. So we're going to be on kind of a break for a while. in terms of making any official changes to the bill. Certainly no activities will take place that are official prior to a week from today. So we'll be looking at a week out for more activities to start again. Let's take a look then at the Senate Finance Committee hearings. And what happened there was, as we knew, the Byrd rule is still a problem, so we knew the chairman was going to come in with revisions. Those revisions were released on the 14th, actually at nearly at midnight on the 14th Eastern Time. So very late in the evening, they were writing up these changes. The revisions are both general revisions that do various things just to fix issues, just like we had in the House Ways and Means Committee, but also some provisions here that clearly are designed to meet the Byrd rule. Some things were removed from the Senate bill. Not surprisingly, the deferred compensation provisions, we talked about those last week. You know, we talked about a couple weeks ago about what they would have done deferred compensation with the House bill, would have basically gotten rid of non-qualified deferred comp. That same provision was in the initial Senate draft. The House eventually pulled that provision, and the first thing we got told by the Senate is they're pulling it as well. So it looks like the deferred comp rules that could have been very nasty and gotten rid of non-qualified deferred comp looks like they're going to stay out of the bill, at least for now. The Senate also had some worker classification and reporting rules that were going to be in their bill. That has been pulled from the bill as of right now. They also had a provision that would have expanded early distribution tax to certain distributions from 457 governmental plans. That has been pulled from this bill, as adds a provision that was going to provide that for certain high-income employees, they would not be able to make catch-up contributions or they would be restricted on their catch-up contributions. That provision also was pulled from the Senate bill, so that's gone. So if you've worried about any of those four provisions, they are no longer in the Senate bill. Now, the big thing the Senate did was, which got all the news this week, was in 2019, now it is important because the news often skipped over this little detail, the shared responsibility payment would be set to zero in 2019. What you probably heard people say was, you know, that the Senate was repealing the individual mandate. That's not correct in a couple of important features. Number one, obviously it is 2019, not 2018. So, and of course, most press coverage I listen to never quite mention when it would be. And secondly, they didn't really remove the mandate. Here's what they did. You still have to have qualifying coverage. That's still what the law says. However, the penalty for not having qualifying coverage is simply set to zero. So they didn't actually take the provision out of the law. They merely set the penalty to zero. That makes it very easy to restore the penalty, right? If there's a change in control of Congress, if Congress just decides that maybe there are problems when this happens, you know, obviously the concern, the prediction is that this will cause rates to spike in 2019. If for some reason Congress looks out and says, hey, that might be happening, they could add this back quickly. You know, I'm not sure why, to be though totally honest, it wasn't just pulled out, you know, when the idea was to get rid of it. But apparently we're getting rid, but not really getting rid of this provision. So to put it very simply, they made it very easy for it to come back with a very minor change to the law. They also modified slightly the rates. They did keep, you know, all the various rates. We're going to have a 10%, 12%, 22%, 24%, 32%, 35%, 38.5% brackets. What they did, they lowered some of those rates by 0.5%. They expanded some brackets. So they made some minor changes there to make it to increase the amount of the tax cut that was going to go to individuals. However, we're going to discover they're going to work around that by having a sunset provision that's going to reduce that cost. They also raised the child tax credit to $2,000. That had been an important push that was both Senators Mike Lee and Marco Rubio were pushing hard for that to go all the way to $2,000. The Senate now has raised it to that amount. It will not be fully refundable, but it will be $2,000. Senator Rubio has said that he's pushing for full refundability of it. So, but as he said, this is a starting point. So he's, you know, he's relatively happy where we are. The individual cuts, the child credit, and what we're going to find out about the pass-through deduction we talked about last week, the 17.4% deduction, those, however, are all not going to expire at the end of 2025. By cutting them off at the end of 2025, that gives the Senate enough room. You know, on paper, what will happen in 2025, individual taxes will go up, and for some people, rather dramatically. And that will provide the revenue that allows them to keep the corporate cuts permanent. Now, the betting is, to be totally honest, and this is what you're going to be told by anybody, is that Congress is not about to let this fiscal cliff issue arise again. And when 2025 comes around, they will vote to extend these one more time. But that time, Congress will be voting to extend what would be a fiscal cliff problem. The theory being Congress will then waive any rules or any problems because they don't want to be facing this giant cut to individual tax rates, this giant individual tax increase. So the idea is it will be passed then. In any event, though, on paper, this is part of the reason why when you look at the math, you're going to suddenly see some issues that say that's going to cost a lot more money for individual taxpayers after a few years. A lot of that has to do with these expirations. And, you know, if they're real, yes, they would cost a lot more. If they're not real, then they don't. But if they're not real, then the deficit increase is much higher than stated. So it depends upon, you know, which problem you want to look at, you know, which way that goes. Additionally, we have the pass-through 17.4% deduction. We changed that rule. Remember last week we were going to get a 17.4% deduction for pass-through income, but it's going to be limited to one half of the W-2 income that was allocable to you. Well, now that W-2 rule is only going to apply to taxpayers with income over $500,000. As well, everybody, not just those who weren't in service businesses, would get the pass-through, but it was going to be limited to people with incomes under about $150,000. They now have decided to increase that deduction for people with pass-through from service businesses to the same $500,000 or $250,000 limit. That's going to be much higher in the Senate bill. They added a provision that said there's a provision that allows farms to, you know, get out of that full interest deduction. They'll get out of not being able to deduct all their interest. They give up expensing. Well, the bill now said if a farm does that, they also have to agree to longer depreciation periods for their property. So in order to get a full deduction for interest, it's going to be a little more costly for a farm than it was before. But apparently Hollywood has some connections here because qualified film, television, and live theatrical production property is now going to qualify for 100% bonus depreciation under the rule. So the Senate moved for that purpose. Also moving here, the Senate reduced the ADS period for residential rentals to 30 years. So if you're using ADS depreciation on a rental, we'll shorten that up by about 10 years. Remember, they also reduced the regular makers period to 25 years. Now, that was a minor reduction for residential rentals from 27.5, but still a reduction. Raising some more money, they're going to require net operating loss. Remember, we had that 90% limitation on offsetting income with net operating losses in the future. That number is going to drop to 80% in the Senate bill beginning in 2023. Now, hold on to that because there is a way this may not stay bad for a very long time based on a special rule the Senate put in, but initially, your net operating losses, instead of 90%, they'll initially be 90% offset, but then after a couple of years, they're going to go to 80% offset. So you only offset 80% of future income. That's obviously a revenue raiser again. The Senate is going to remove any deduction for meals provided for the convenience of the employer. As you may be aware now, if we have a meal provided for the convenience of the employer, generally we're able to exclude that from the employee's W-2. And if we're providing it in the, you know, if we have a eating facility, we provide it for the convenience of the employer, we're allowed to take a full deduction for it. Well, now, under this rule, while apparently we'll still be able to keep it out of the W-2 of the employee, what we won't be able to do is take any deduction whatsoever for this payment. So it would go down to zero. So if you do a lot of that, you know, well, you know, I guess staffers at CPA firms will just have to live without the pizzas on Saturday, or the firms are going to have to eat that deduction. Choice, you got to figure out if it's pizza or the, you know, are you going to go ahead and keep the pizza in? Or are we going to go ahead and have to tell the staff they have to pay for the pizza? Well, that's your choice. You know, figure out how that one's going to work. We're also going to allow an ABLE contribution to be made by the beneficiary. This is an additional amount annually of a contribution to an ABLE account. An ABLE account is what I kind of consider to be the poor man's special needs trust. It's able to be set up with all the complications of that. It's able to be used by the disabled person. Now, remember, they had to be disabled early in life because of the way the ABLE accounts work. But if they do that, we set this account up. It can be used for qualified disability expenses. It doesn't count against them for qualification for most benefits. But the issue is that when this person dies, after we pay for their funeral, any remaining funds in the ABLE account go to the state in order to pay for the probably Medicaid to a large extent for long-term care that they were paying for this individual. Well, this person can now increase the ABLE account by the lesser of the federal poverty level for the year or the amount of their own compensation they earn for the year. So if this disabled individual is earning income, they'll be able to put an amount, they'll be able to put into the account an additional amount for themselves up to either the federal poverty level or what they earn for the year. So this would allow the disabled person themselves to take these earnings and throw them into the ABLE account. That would allow them to save these funds for use for their life and not have them count against them because they now have too much in the way of assets. So it's one of those things that's in there for this account. Don't know how many. Again, you've got to have a special client that has somebody qualified for ABLE accounts, and then they've got to be earning the money that they want to throw in the account and be able to want to throw this much in. But if all those things are true, then this could be very helpful. Also in the Senate's, in the chairman's revisions, those ABLE contributions that are made will now qualify for the saver's credit. Remember, that's a special credit you can get for putting funds into a retirement account. Well, that credit will now be available to for ABLE contributions as well. They did pick up from the House bill the ability to roll over funds between a 529 plan and ABLE plan. Now, that could be useful for a family because, remember, you can roll in 529 plans between, you know, from one sibling to another. Well, in this case, we could roll from, let's say, a 529 plan for one sibling. And, you know, we have excess funds left over in that plan now after we paid for, you know, Mary's education. John was disabled early in life. He's a qualified beneficiary for 529 plan. We could take the remaining balance in Mary's 529 and put that into John's ABLE account. So we can make a direct rollover that way. And we could do it between the two parties. The Senate also, they picked up some provisions that are just like, well, they must have been lying around somewhere. Somebody wanted them. They extended the time that you could contest an IRS levy. It's going to grow from 9 months to 2 years now, so a longer time to contest the IRS's levying authority. And another IRS levy-related item is that they allow for special relief if you have, let's say, the IRS is levying for taxes against you, and they make a levy against your IRA account or your employer retirement account, and they end up getting money out of there. Now, later on, it's determined that that was improper and that the money shouldn't have come out of the account. So they pay the money back to you, and they give you back earnings on the money. Well, the problem is, in more than 60 days had passed, you couldn't put that money back in the account. Now, under these rules, we're going to be allowed to put that money back into the account once we get it in our hands. And even though we're past the 60-day period, we'll still be able to treat that as a qualified rollover and be able to treat it, therefore, as a non-taxable amount received. Yeah, that works. That, you know, that'll be useful in those situations where that happens. They also, apparently the Senate doesn't like the fact the IRS was making user installment agreements more expensive, so they didn't roll back the fees, but they are going to prohibit future increases in user fees for installment agreements by the IRS. So, you know, the installment agreement fees will stay basically where they are, will be the way this would work if the law passes with this in it. They also added, remember they added that special rule where you could claim a refund for payments you had received because you've been improperly incarcerated, and they opened up statutes. This just continues one more year for that open statute rule. So again, if you have a client that was affected by that, that looks like was going to miss the rule, well, now they can get it. All that means. The Senate, now the House had gotten rid of the above-the-line deduction for educator expenses entirely, but the Senate's going to increase that number to $500 in their bill. So that'll be a different, but educators. Now remember, below the line, any 2% deduction is gone in the Senate bill. Employee business expenses are gone in the House bill, so this will be the total amount that your educator can get, and those employees who aren't educators, for the most part, are going to get nothing. some limited exceptions for certain things in the military, but otherwise not going to happen. They also added the provision we had added in the House, where there's not going to be any deduction allowed for attorneys where they advance litigation costs in a contingent fee case, you know, that would be reimbursed if they won the case out of the contingent fee in addition to their fee. They're going to have to hold those expenses until the end of the case, the contingency is resolved. There was a split among the circuits regarding how this should be handled. Congress has now said we're going to resolve the split by making it clear in the law how we want this resolved. Apparently, we don't have enough tax forms, so the Senate is going to order the IRS to devise a new form 1040-SR. And it's going to be a simplified return for those over age 65. What it really is going to be the 1040-EZ expanded for things that currently aren't on the form, like, you know, pensions and your Social Security. But that'll be about it. So it'll be an EZ for those over 65 that will allow them to claim their Medicare, you know, they're not should say Medicare, but claim their Social Security and claim their expenses that, you know, their income from pensions. File therefore the simple return. Again, don't know about how you guys feel about it. In our office, generally, we find that it's easier just work with 1040 for everything. But if you really want to do a 1040-SR, apparently you'll be able to turn on a 1040-SR. We're going to allow, just like the House, a 529 plan to be set up for an unborn child. And just like the House, they did say, oh, it's got to be in utero and it must be a homo sapiens. I have no idea what they thought we're going to do. But the Senate is apparently just as worried as the House that somehow we're going to try to set up these 529 plans for unborn puppies or something. I'm not sure what they thought was going to happen there, but nevertheless, that's to be clear, you cannot set it up for the puppies. Of course, we don't seem to have anything in the law that says you can't set it up for a puppy that's been born. You know, I guess if we need it for this, do we need to clarify for the other? Yeah, I'm still not sure why they're doing it. Research expenses, they will have to be amortized over a 5-year period for any expenses paid after 2025. Now, this one again, there's going to be a thing that takes this back. In fact, it takes this back, as I recall, before it ever comes in if we meet the requirements. But we'll see how that works. We're going to get a 2-year test business credit of 12.5% for wages paid to employees that are on family medical leave, you know, FMLA leave, as long as the employer is paying at least 50% of their regular wage. So remember, FMLA leave is, you know, the employer is not required to pay employees for that leave. They just have to keep the job open. But if an employer decides to pay for the leave, the federal government is going to underwrite part of this, right? As I said, if you pay 50%, they'll underwrite it to 12.5%. And then if you go above 50%, they start stepping it up to a maximum amount of 25% of credit. For what you pay your employees, you know, if you pay them. So if you keep them on the regular payroll, keep paying them what you paid them before, you get a 25% credit. So essentially, the feds would pick up 1/4 of your cost for paying that employee's family, you know, while they're on family medical leave. They're only going to try this for 18 and 19, then they're going to study it, according to the Senate bill. There are some more modifications made to the low-income housing credit. So you'll take a look there. There were some concerns that they were going to make it tougher to get in ways that some people didn't like. So they made some modifications to that. We have a couple of modifications to electing small business trusts with S corporations. This is something we didn't see at all in the House bill, but apparently now in the Senate bill, this is something we're going to see. First thing is ESBT beneficiaries are now going to be expanded to include non-resident aliens. So if you ever want to put a non-resident alien in your electing small business trust, and, you know, hey, now you haven't been able to do so because they wouldn't be an eligible S-Corp shareholder, apparently they can be a shareholder if we have them in a ESBT, if we have an ESBT. My guess is we'll see how this gets written in the end and how it gets written up. Wouldn't surprise me to find out they can be a beneficiary, but if you ever send anything to them, then you kill your S election. But I guess you want to have them in there, you could. And they also will now change the rules, so ESBTs are going to be subject to the individual, not the trust rules for charitable contributions. You know, trust rules for charitable contributions are very different than individual, so we're going to make these like an individual rule. under this instead of having them be subject to the trust rule. The Senate's revision also will allow some fines to be deducted if the taxpayer can show the fine is in the nature of restitution to a party. You know, it still makes the default being that it's not going to be deductible, but if you could show the fine's really restitution, then we're going to allow you a deduction, assuming you carry that burden. They also added some special rules to let people expense the cost of replanting citrus costs following a casualty loss in certain situations. So apparently the citrus farmers got a hold of somebody and got a special provision stuck in the bill. We also added, this makes perfect sense given all the stuff that's been in the news recently, there would be no deduction allowed to an employer, to a company, for a settlement related to sexual harassment claims or sexual abuse claims if the settlement was subject to a non-disclosure agreement. If you want a non-disclosure agreement when you're paying off for sexual harassment or sexual abuse, well, you're just going to have to not claim any deduction on that amount. There have been a number of high profile, especially in the entertainment industry, from a number of issues, number of high profile cases of settlement payments that had been made in the past, but those payments were subject to a non-disclosure agreement. Specifically, we had settlements that involved in the areas of Fox, you know, 21st Century Fox, and in the area of payments with the Weinstein companies, you know, Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein companies. Those payments, well known, they were subject to non-disclosure agreement. Apparently, Congress now decides that's not a good thing, so they're going to disallow those deductions. They're also going to remove, like the House, the rule allowing a charity to use the alternate reporting mechanism on the 990 to substantiate people's charitable contributions. We never had regs to do it. They're getting rid of it. Like the House, we would bar you from recharacterizing your Roth IRA contributions or rollovers as going to regular IRAs before the due date of the return. They felt that was subject to abuse. We would, just like the House bill, we'd extend the period to roll over a distribution that was basically a deemed distribution because you had a loan outstanding with a 401k when you were terminated. You'll have again till the due date of your return to do that under the Senate bill. They would change the taxation of stock options and restrict the stock units. This is not making Silicon Valley happy. Generally, if you get stock options or restricted stock units from a public company, you're going to be taxed on them when they vest, not when you exercise them, right? If you have a non-public company and you qualify, and the Senate has more restrictive rules too, not all people receiving options in non-public companies will qualify under their rules, you must elect to defer recognition upon vesting. If you do not elect, it will be immediately subject to tax. And again, you can only delay it for no more than 5 years, and the stock cannot be publicly traded. So public companies will not have access to this. Public companies, therefore, you're probably going to see the end of non-qualified stock options, or maybe we'll put it better, you're going to see immediate exercise when you vest. There'll be little reason not to exercise. There are additional limitations on this up to five-year deferral. Those will apply. So again, for the most part, we're greatly restricting the use of non-qualified stock options and restricted stock units. Certainly, you're not going to be able to sit on them for an extended period of time. Once you vest, it's fully taxable. We have some changes now in this bill will disappear in 2026 if we meet 10-year revenue targets. So there's a revenue. If our revenue is high enough by 2026, some of these things will not happen. For instance, one thing that will go away is that net operating loss 80% rule will go back to 90%. So we won't have the 80% rule in place. We'll now still be able to deduct meals provided for the convenience of the employer. That will come back to the law. And we won't have to amortize research expenses. So I guess all good news, right? Now if revenue comes in higher. Remember, one of the claims for this bill is that the growth generated by this bill is going to cause so much growth to take place that in fact, you know, it'll pay for itself. Well, if you got one of those three deductions, one of those three negative items that you really don't want to see happen, you're going to hope like mad that this bill really does have that growth, because we need that growth to make sure these things don't happen in the future. What happens now with this bill? Okay, Senate Finance Committee kicked it out. By the way, the chairman has a few more amendments that he's going to want to have made on the floor, and he released those late on Friday. But where do we have now? Well, Congress is now in the Thanksgiving recess, so there'll be no formal action the coming week. However, don't be surprised there's a lot of informal action and some contacts to see what's going on, what people will need to vote for this bill, how things have to change. I fully expect the Senate bill to see changes on the floor. Unlike the House bill, where they were stating very openly that once it got to the floor, there'd be no changes, this one I think they're considering they probably are going to make some changes. They're going to start probably getting a whip count together here sometime, probably this week even, I would expect them to at least, in a preliminary basis, start reaching out at least to senators they believe may be questionable votes to figure out what might need to change in the bill to get their vote to see if they can make the whip count up to 50. They're definitely looking. Remember, they need 50 votes in the Senate. If they got 50, that would be a tie if all senators voted. But in case of a tie, Vice President Pence would break the tie, presumably in favor of the Republicans, presumably in favor of passing the bill. So we need 50 votes. So basically, they'd like to get this done. Now, they're also racing one other thing. We have a December 12th election in Alabama, and there's lots of reasons to believe that regardless of who wins that election in Alabama, it may not be automatic that that person would, even if the Republican wins, that that person will vote for the bill. So we may also see them try to get all of this done by December 12th. But they definitely want to pass by the beginning of December. Once they pass it, we would go to conference. Now, depending on, and again, I think because of the issue with the Alabama seat, I think if the Senate can pass it with 52 votes, they probably don't care too much about what happens with the Alabama seat. But if they pass it with, let's say, 50 votes, then suddenly there's a problem here because, you may need that Alabama vote. We fully expect Luther Strange, the current senator holding that seat in Alabama, who will not be the senator after the 12th, to vote for the bill. But we're not sure, even if the Republican wins, Roy Moore, that he's necessarily going to vote for this bill. There is some concern that he might hold back his vote for various reasons. So maybe a problem. This also opens up one thing you have to consider, and you need to think back to the Affordable Care Act and what happened when that came out of the Senate. When the Affordable Care Act passed the Senate, we had, again, another senator like Luther Strange who was holding his post. He would have been appointed to temporarily fill the Senate post of the recently deceased Senator Edward Kennedy. He voted for the bill. After the Senate voted for a bill and passed the bill that actually eventually became the Affordable Care Act, that really was the ACA, the election was held in Massachusetts, and surprise, the Republican won. The Republican was not going to vote for the ACA, so that forced the House to accept the bill the Senate had passed. Conceivably, this Alabama election causes the same problem. The Senate could pass the bill, but they needed every vote. They got 50. They needed Luther Strange's vote. When Luther's not there after the election, they may not be able to get 50 votes again, so we may be back to where the House is told you just have to accept what the Senate passed. If that's the case, then whether the Senate puts back the $10,000 real property tax deduction could be very interesting because, again, is the House bluffing? Would they really deny the whole thing over the $10,000 real estate tax deduction? Or are they not bluffing, and do we need that in there to get it through the House? And if we do, then either it needs to come out of the bill, then it needs to be in the bill coming out of the Senate right now, which would give them the option of passing a bill without having to go back to the Senate, or need to be able to get it back through the Senate on a revote. So it'll be an interesting thing to run. So in any event, hey, we're in Thanksgiving week. So make sure you have a happy Thanksgiving to all of us tax geeks, right? All of us out here doing tax work. After Thanksgiving, actually, I'm going to be at a couple of tax conferences. By the way, that's where we're going to be talking about a lot of this stuff coming up new. And I'm not presenting on this issue, but your state societies, a lot of them now are holding, some hold in early on November, others hold in December. But certainly in almost every one of those, somebody's going to be getting up and trying to explain to you what's going on with this, you know, what's gone on with the bill at the time you hold the conference. I'll be actually presenting the week after Thanksgiving. I'll be both in Oklahoma at the Oklahoma Tax Institute, and I'll be presenting at, so that's Thursday I'll present there. Friday I will present at the Minnesota Tax Conference, okay? Both conferences are running Thursday and Friday the week after, you know, basically the week after Thanksgiving. And I'll be presenting day one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, day two in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I will then the following week be presenting at New Mexico's Tax Conference in Albuquerque. That'll be held a week after, so a week from that Friday, so a couple weeks out, I'll be in Albuquerque. So I'm doing tax conferences all over the place. So it's just that time of year to do tax conferences. So we'll be talking about that. Also be doing a number of courses around the West. I'll be in New Mexico doing a course there. That we'll be talking about in New Mexico, doing about depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets. I'll be doing some courses in Phoenix for Arizona ethics. By the way, for those of you in Arizona, the board did finally release the final regulation, so we had some talk about ethics this year. It's different. We'll be talking about Arizona taxes and current federal tax developments. I'll be going up to Boise, Idaho to talk about a course of both partnerships, a day on pure partnership issues, including the audit issues, in fact, majorly the audit issues that we're going to talk about there, what's coming with the audit regime, and then also talk a bit about what's happening with pastors in general. So look at some of the issues with ESSAs, because we've had some interesting S developments, too, recent couple of years. And then I'll be going on to Miami, Florida, where I'll be talking about partnerships and real estate partnerships, and then also doing another current federal tax development session there in Miami, Florida, at the Marriott at the Miami International Airport. So if you're in any of those places, I hope to see you before we're done with this CP season. Otherwise, come back here next week. I'll talk to you about updates, and I'll probably talk about cases this week. I actually get, you know, because nobody will be in Washington to do anything with the tax law. Be sure to visit our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll write up what happens this week and also tell you about some things that may have happened while we've been distracted with this tax bill. You can also follow me on Twitter. You can follow me at Ed Zollers as I post things. I tend to post things that go up on the website there. If you have any questions or comments about the new tax bill or about anything else that's happening in taxes, you can email me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And be sure to check your state CPA Society catalog for courses that are going to be given by us here at the Lascalzo Institute. We give courses on both accounting and tax issues, so check your way there. But in any event, I look forward to seeing you all next week when we'll talk about just regular old developments before going back to the saga of can Congress pass comprehensive tax reform before the end of the year. You got to stay tuned here. It's going to be a cliffhanger. And we'll talk to you later.